It's KZSU Stanford. It's Monday, and it's time once again for another edition of the Lunch Special, and a very special one today, too.
Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy, and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning, I come following you. Though I know that evening's empire has returned into sand, vanished from my hand, left me blindly here to stand, but still not sleeping. My weariness amazes me, I am branded on my feet. I have no one to meet, and the ancient empty streets too dead for dreaming. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy, and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning, I come following you. Take me on a trip upon your magic swirling ship. My senses have been stripped, my hands can't feel to grip, my toes too numb to step. Wait only for my boot heels to be wandering. To fade into my own parade, cast your dance and spill my way. I promise to go under it. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy, and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In a jingle jangle morning, I come following you. Though you might hear laughing, spinning, swinging madly across the sun, it's not aimed at anyone, it's just escaping on the run. And but for the sky, there are no fences facing. And if you hear vague traces of skipping reels of rhyme to your tambourine in time, it's just a ragged clown behind. I wouldn't pay it any mind. It's just a shadow you're seeing that he's chasing. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy, and there is no place I'm going to. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In a jingle jangle morning, I come following you. Disappearing through the smoke rings of my mind, down the foggy ruins of time, far past the frozen leaves, the haunted, frightened trees, out to the windy beach, far from the twisted reach of crazy sorrow. Yes, to dance beneath the diamond sky with one hand waving free, silhouetted by the sea, circled by the circus sands, with all memory and fate driven deep beneath the waves. Let me forget about today until tomorrow. Hey, Mr. tambourine man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy, and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In a jingle jangle morning, I come following you.
Little Bob Dylan for your listening pleasure this afternoon. Welcome to another edition of KZSU's Lunch Special, heard every Monday at noon right here on KZSU Stanford. And today, local author, local a lot of stuff, got his PhD here at Stanford, James Fadiman, and his new book, The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide. We're going to get into that. We're going to play a little music. And Jim, you told me to call you Jim when you first got in here.
Absolutely.
So I'm going to call you Jim. And why don't you go ahead and just briefly introduce yourself to the folks, and then I want to get into this book.
Okay. I am very local. Did get a not only a PhD at Stanford, but it's the only PhD Stanford ever gave on psychedelic research.
Wow.
And they didn't feel good about it at the time, and I'm not sure that anything's changed. And I've... Did help establish the Institute for Transpersonal Psychology in Palo Alto, and we're in our 35th year giving PhDs. And only in our 35th year did we have our first course in how clinical psychologists should learn to work with people who've had a lot of psychedelic experience.
And one thing that struck me about your book is page one, after all the introductions and some fine quotes, you've been... You had some very, very nice friends say a lot of good things about this book. On page one, you open it up by saying, each of us must decide for ourselves whether to put into our bodies what affects our minds, be it micrograms of a chemical, milligrams of a mushroom, ounces of an alcoholic beverage, or smoke from burning tobacco. This book explores the beneficial uses of psychedelics, LSD in particular. It does not advocate illegal activities of any kind. To become more aware of your birthright, denying anyone access to any facet of reality in the name of religion, science, medicine, or law serves neither the individual nor society. Whenever opportunities for self-realization are suppressed or are in danger of being lost, there is a moral imperative to protect and restore them. This book has been written so that certain knowledge, experiences, and techniques for increased awareness would not vanish. That's an amazing summary. And why don't you expound on that?
Well, I was very moved by it myself. I've never heard it read aloud and in such a good voice.
Thank you.
Yeah, in a sense, some years ago, I realized that what we're talking about is freedom. And there are three kinds of freedom that I'm really interested in, and most people agree with me, which is, it seems to me we have a inherent freedom to discover our own spiritual core. We have freedom for self-exploration to better understand ourselves. And as scientists, we also have the freedom to understand how the universe works. And those three freedoms, the freedom to do science, to do self-research, and to do spiritual work, all relate to the correct and careful and safe and smart use of psychedelics. So I realize I'm on the side of really what the Constitution and democracy and so forth are about, which is how can we maintain the best uses of personal freedom without basically getting into trouble.
James Fadiman is our guest today. He's got a brand new book out called The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide, and he'll be having a book event this coming Thursday at Kepler's at 7 o'clock. And all you got to do is show up. Now, there is limited seating, so first come, first serve. There's a meet and greet between 6:30 and 7, and then the program starts at 7, and he'll be reading from his book and answering questions. That's at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park, 1010 El Camino Real. Everybody knows where it is, or if you don't, just Google it. But let's go back to the start. You were born in Southern California, in Los Angeles?
Right. I was... My parents were in the film industry, actually. My father was in the literary side. He was a story editor for Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, and then he worked for Howard Hughes.
Hmm.
So I grew up, I guess, in a land where reality was stretchable, at least on screen. And his only wish for me was that I not go into the film business, and so far, so good.
Yeah, but your wife.
I did marry a wife who is now a world-famous filmmaker, and I actually did do a couple of films, a series of films for KQED called Drugs, The Children Are Choosing. And it was at the time when adults were running around being just frightened by their own children, and the children were learning to not trust the medical authorities. And so I did a series of films that hopefully bridged a little of the gap.
How long ago was that?
That was in the early 70s.
That stuff's probably still around somewhere, isn't it?
Very obscure.
So let's start from where you grew up. What led you on this path to end up where you ended up in psychedelic research? Did it start back in your childhood? Or
no, unfortunately, I was not one of these children with a host of mystical experiences in childhood and invisible friends and guides from outer space. I always liked those kids, but I was not one of them. I was just a bright, normal, slightly neurotic teenager, and went to college and retained most of that. And then after I graduated, I was living in Paris for a year, writing the not-quite-so-great American novel. And my old professor, Professor Richard Alpert, arrived on his way to Copenhagen with Professor Timothy Leary and the author Aldous Huxley. And they were going off to talk about something they'd discovered while I was away. And Richard Alpert, who'd been my mentor and friend, said, "The greatest thing in the world has happened to me, and I'd like to share it with you." And I looked at him, and I thought, wow, he's really in good shape. And I said, sure. And he reached into his breast pocket and took out a little pill bottle, and I thought, what on earth is going on? And he said, here, take a couple of these. And we sat at a cafe, and it got brighter and more cheerful and more colorful, and I was hearing all the conversations as people walked by in French, and my French wasn't very good, so normally I didn't hear that at all. And I finally said to him, this is really too much for me. Can we go someplace quiet? And he looked at me and said, it's really too much for me too, and I haven't taken anything, but I've never been in Paris before. So we retreated up to my fourth floor walk-up, and my life changed because I was introduced to parts of myself that I never knew existed that were on the whole quite remarkable, opening, and beneficial.
So that was your first experience with LSD?
Well, it was actually with psilocybin at what we would now call a moderate dose, but it was my first psychedelic experience. And it was my first experience is that there was more to the world than I had been taught.
Very interesting. And psilocybin, LSD, what's the difference?
The main difference between LSD and psilocybin is that the duration of effect is different. LSD is 8 to 10 hours, psilocybin is 5 to 7. All the other differences that are written all over the place are predominantly because of setting and dose, which is what kind of situation are you in, what kind of support have you got, how much do you know and the people around you know, and literally how much are you taking. You take too much of any of these substances, it's easy to get in trouble, and people have, and if you take the right amount of these substances without guidance, it's easy to get in trouble, and a lot of people have.
Mm-hmm. James Fadiman, the guest today, the Psychedelic Explorer's Guide is just coming out now. It's on Park Street Press. He'll be at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park Thursday night at 7 o'clock. You've been called America's wisest and most respected authority on psychedelics and their use. How does that hit you?
Oh, I think that's just wonderful. I guess somebody has to be in that group. And there are a small group of us who have been involved in this for 30, 40 years. And having stayed moderately respectable in most of my other sides of my career, it's a fair statement to say that if you want to know something serious about this, I probably am as useful as anyone else in asking that question. If you want to know how to drop at concerts, you got the wrong guy.
Very good. The phrase after the Psychedelic Explorer's Guide on your book says, safe, therapeutic, and sacred journeys. One of the things I really enjoyed about your book was it's not you just writing a book. You've used all the research. You put together all the research from all your from many wide sources, and a lot of these people had done the tests and had the information. And I'd like you to get into that story too, because when you got into your studies on psychedelics, the government came along and shut you down.
Well, we were a few years in, and what's nice is that the people who introduced me to the research out here in Menlo Park were Stanford professors. Stanford's had a very delicate relationship with the psychedelic world, which is they were terrified for a while in the 60s that they would be known as the Harvard of the West, because Leary and Alpert had been fired from Harvard, and there was a lot of national controversy, and quietly, several professors at Stanford were working at a nonprofit in Menlo Park, and for a while I was their psychologist. And we had government permission, no government funding, and we were offering this experience to people as a therapeutic, both therapeutic and just to make your life more rich and interesting. So you didn't have to be sick in order to be better.
And that's what your study really is about, like it says in the book, Safe, Therapeutic, and Sacred Journeys. And speak about that. I was really impressed with all the information that's in this book about the application, that one needs a guide. You have a whole chapters on this, and what you guys have found out in the studies, and different dosage too, small dose, big dose, medium dose.
Let me just frame it very, very simply, and I was surprised by the time I got the book written that it could break down by dosage levels, which is high dose, 300, 400, 500 of LSD, is a kind of a psycho-spiritual or entheogenic, God-manifesting, go to the center of creation kind of experience.
Come to Jesus moment.
Well, Jesus is one of the things you meet along the way, but Jesus sits at a big table, and there's a lot of folks there.
I'll bet.
Because Jesus was a teacher, after all, and so was Buddha, and so forth and so on. At a lower dose, a couple of hundred, is where most of the psychotherapeutic work is done, where you're still inside your own identity. You still are limited, so to speak, in imagining that your mind and body stop at the edge of your skin. And that's where all the therapy is done, and that's where most of the research now is being done in a number of areas, in a number of countries. Research is coming back after 40 years of a lull, as one of my colleagues says. I used to call it government repression, but a lull seems a lot nicer. And below that, around 100 micrograms, is where you do creative problem solving on hard-ass scientific problems, chip design, architectural design, mathematical theory. And that was what work came out of, really, the Stanford professors and I and some other people. And then way below that, at 10 micrograms, is what's called a tenor, or sub-perceptual dosing, which means that there is no particular change in awareness that you're noticing or anyone else is, but at those very low doses, people find that they have slightly more creative capacity for more hours per day. So it looks like a cognitive enhancer. And Albert Hofmann, who was the developer of LSD, said those very low-dose areas were the under-researched areas, and he was very sorry over the years that his parent pharmaceutical company never pursued that part of it.
Do you think psychedelics played any part in the forming of Silicon Valley?
Well, there's a wonderful, wonderful book called What the Dormouse Said, which says it looks to this author, who is the John Markoff, who is the science reporter for the New York Times, and he said, why did Silicon Valley arise here when all the computer heavies were on the East Coast? And what he found out was that psychedelics and the younger computer people were interacting enormously, and that a vast amount of what we would now call Silicon Valley is based on the people who were working really hard in computer science and working with psychedelics.
Maybe it should be called Psychedelic Valley.
Well, let us say that someone pointed out, we're no longer making anything with silicon.
There was a list of people in the back of the book, and Steve Jobs' name came up.
Yes, yeah, Steve is has said, and he doesn't talk about it, but he has said that his own LSD experiences were among the more important items in his life. John Markoff got that in an unguarded moment in an interview. And there's a film out, a fiction film, of the early founding of Apple, with Jobs running in, having just had a psychedelic experience, and talking about it. So, yes, it's there. We don't know about Bill Gates, since he doesn't talk much about his personal life. He just says, that was all when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
But we do have a couple of Nobel Prize winners who've talked about their LSD experiences and how it was critical to the work for which they got Nobel Prizes. So it's clear that it can be and has been used by scientists of all sorts for problem solving. And that's an area which I'm hoping to kind of reignite, because why should we deliberately not make use of part of our brains in terms of technological innovation? It just seems to me a little short-sighted as a national policy.
James Fathom is our guest. The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide is his new book, Safe Therapeutic and Sacred Journeys. He's going to be at Kepler's this Thursday night, 7 o'clock. You can get there at 6:30 for a meet and greet. That's in Menlo Park. You can also go on his website, which is jamesfathoman.com. And why don't we play another song, because you brought some great music today.
Okay.
And we're going to play Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Is this a psychedelic song?
Well, the Beatles have denied it for years, but I think recently they stopped denying it.
Very cool.
Picture yourself in a boat on a river, with tangerine trees and marmalade skies. Somebody calls you, you answer quite slowly. A girl with kaleidoscope eyes. Celebrate flowers of yellow and green, towering over your head. Look for the girl with the sun in her eyes, and she's gone. Lucy in the sky with diamonds. Lucy in the sky with diamonds. Lucy in the sky with diamonds.
Follow her down to a bridge by a fountain. Her rocking horse people eat marshmallow pies. Everyone smiles as you drift past the flowers that grow so incredibly high. Newspaper taxis appear on the shore, waiting to take you. Train in a station with plasticine pauses, with looking glass ties. Suddenly someone is there at the turnstile, the girl with kaleidoscope eyes.
Lucy in the sky with diamonds.
a psychedelic song for our author today, James Fadiman. The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide is his new book, Safe, Therapeutic, and Sacred Journeys. And Jim, I've been waiting to ask you this question: How wide is the usage of LSD in the United States and the world too? Do we have any handle? Do you have a handle on that?
Well, I can give you a handle on the United States use, and it's probably the lowest possible number because this is from the federal government asking you what drugs are you using, and I would imagine only underreporting.
Of course.
Who's gonna answer that? So the total is approximately LSD alone. Not any of the other substances, and certainly not ecstasy, 23 million in the U.S. And what's more interesting about it for me is that that figure goes up about 600,000 a year, which means at least 600,000 people in the United States alone are going to try LSD this year.
Hmm.
And one of the reasons I wrote the book is if you're going to do it, why don't you do it safely?
Yeah, because when you buy stuff off the street, you don't know what you're getting.
Well, it's not that necessary. That's one of the problems. But usually, if it's not LSD, it's not anything special.
Yeah.
But the thing is, if you're using something like LSD or psilocybin or mescaline or any of the other dozen substances, you need to know not only what you're having, but what you're doing and who you're doing it with. I've been doing some research on bad trips, and almost everybody says, after they say, I had a bad trip, they then say, and here's why it was a bad trip, and they give you the correct reasons. Bad friends, bad timing, bad weather, you know, we were rained out, or my car burst into flame. You know, that makes for a very bad afternoon.
It can, yeah.
And most of all is not having a guide. You know, it's like when you go to Africa and you're on a safari. The guide doesn't see any animals through your eyes. You do all the seeing. You do all the walking. You do all looking around. But he just has a few little hints, like, I wouldn't walk right over there. That's an anthill. Or, you see that rhinoceros that's charging us? If I were you, and it's really up to you, I would stand behind a tree. So a guide is someone who, by protecting you, lets you do more and lets you go farther and safer. And so I'm a kind of guide fanatic.
That struck me, too, in the reading of your book that I hadn't heard about that before in your research. And why don't you talk about that? How is an LSD or a psychedelic experiment set up with the guide and just kind of paint the picture of the whole setting, how you would do that?
If you're doing it as well as possible, you're in a living room and you have good music available. And you have a guide who is not taking any material of any sort, and they're just there to be with you. And there's flowers, and there's beautiful things in the room.
Should it be somebody you know?
It should be someone you know, and it shouldn't necessarily be your partner, because unless your relationship is so good that that's not an issue.
Mm-hmm.
But it should be someone you know, and someone who knows more than you do. I mean, that's what a guide is. Just as if I want to, you know, take a guide on the, if I want to ask someone where to go on the New York subway, I want somebody who knows the subway system. They don't have to be a divinely realized being, but they have to know the subway system.
Now, does the guide try to engage the subject during the experiment?
That's the wonderful thing about psychedelics. The guide does not engage the subject if possible, only when necessary.
Just stay out of the way, basically?
Get out of the way. And again, what we found independently in the West, we created that music is a wonderful tool to help your mind expand to its full capacity.
Well, that's why the Fillmore was so popular.
And why music's been popular with every culture we've ever heard of,
mm-hmm.
for various reasons. And then the people from South America who said, oh, yeah, we've been using psychedelics for 20 or 30,000 years. And we say, well, how do you use them? You say, well, we have a very comfortable, safe setting. We prefer night. And we also always use music. We have specific music that goes with each particular plant and with many different conditions. So we independently kind of arose, you know, came to what the shamans have been doing for the last few thousand years.
This is a very interesting study and work by Jim Fadiman. His new book, The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide, Safe, Therapeutic, and Sacred Journeys, and it's on Park Street Press. Now, we were talking off mic, and you mentioned that one of your latest projects is working with a young organization.
Students for Sensible Drug Policy is a wonderful group of people who are basically saying, if you're going to have drug laws, why don't you have drug laws that are based on science and are based on justice, which are two of the things we don't have much of in our drug legislation. And so there turns out to be, last year there were 150 chapters at colleges across the country. This year there are 200. And they feel that repealing laws which harm people more than the drug, that's kind of the criteria, is the law worse than the punishment? So they're basically working to, and doing very well, as you've noted, in beginning to move marijuana out of its closet, because it is so far one of the safest drugs around, and it seems to have enormous potential for multiple sclerosis, some fascinating research on cancer cells, and for people under cancer treatment, for appetite control, kind of lots of medical uses. And people who are pushing marijuana, and that's really not my major interest, but they just have one sentence usually that handles it. They say, you know, tobacco is regulated, it brings in billions of dollars in taxes, and it kills 400,000 people a year in the United States. Marijuana is unregulated, more widely used, at least at the high school level now, than tobacco. And the death toll so far in with marijuana over the past 10 years is zero. And that ends the argument.
That can be proven, the zero part?
That's the federal government's figure.
Oh, wow. Right. That's amazing.
Now, have people who've smoked marijuana had other problems in their lives? Of course. Have people who've had Foster's freeze had other problems in their life? And the answer is, of course. So that's not the issue. The issue is, from the student point of view, since students are the main users of all these substances, they would like regulation. They would like to have assurance that they're getting pure materials. They would like to make sure that children who are too young really don't have access. What children tell me in middle school is that marijuana is much more available than alcohol.
Hmm.
And that doesn't seem to me the best possible way. And certainly for the students in all these chapters, they think the same thing.
Students for Sensible Drug Policy. What are you going to be doing with them, Jim?
Well, the president and I have been talking about it, and she said, you know, the fact is that our chapters really know about as much about marijuana as they care to know at this point, because we've, you know, that's been their main interest. But she said the next thing they really are concerned about and want to know more about for their own safety and general interest are psychedelics. So I'm hoping to work with a number of student chapters and basically turn them on to the idea of safe, sane, sacred work with these substances if they're going to do it. It's a little bit like the sex education people. There are two groups. One says people aren't going to have sex if we tell them it's bad, and the other group says there's zero data on your side, and our side says since they're going to have sex anyway, why don't we make it as safe and as sacred and as wonderful as possible? And so that's kind of where I am with this. And so far, so good.
Gabor Mate is a physician from Vancouver that Amy Goodman found. And he's in what they call harm reduction. And Amy Goodman has aired that out on her show quite a bit lately, the last couple of years. And I wasn't even aware of what it was. But that whole science of helping people. If they're going to get high anyway, just make sure they're not going to hurt themselves.
Well, I'm really pushing a little harder than that, which is harm reduction. There's a lot out there on harm reduction, really some good stuff. And certainly people like Sanctuary at Burning Man is all for that. A lot of concerts now have kind of safety zones where people can chill out. I'm for not only harm reduction, but I'm for benefit enhancement, which is if you're going to use something, why not use it for what it seems to be designed for, and why not use it as well as possible? Mm-hmm. See, where I come from, early on, we did a study, first 100 people who were working at this Menlo Park place in the 60s when we were doing this research on how could you use it well. And we basically asked them how important was this experience. And on the first 100 people, 78 of them said it was, if not the most, one of the most important experiences of their entire life. And my figuring is, if you're doing something that has a 8 out of 10 chances of being the most important experience of your life, or close to that, wouldn't you rather do it right?
Sure. Of course. What do you want people to take away from this? What's the message in your book?
The main message of this book is there are a lot of ways to use these substances really well for science, for therapy, for spiritual growth, and for just kind of cognitively enhanced normal daily life.
Mm-hmm.
That's terrific. There's no need or reason to think that you're going to get in trouble if you use them right. Now, someone beat me up on a website recently saying, how come he doesn't talk about recreation and dropping? And the answer is, which I handle in about two lines, is lots of people have already talked about it. I'm talking about things that people don't know, some things they have that have been obscured just because a lot of our research was coming out as the government was shutting down. And it's very hard to go to a journal and say, would you like to do this article on a substance which no one of your readers can ever do anything with again? And they'd say, no thanks. So some of this is old research. Some of it is research that I'm literally doing as we speak. There's some research going on across the country now. And the other thing I'll give to your reader, to your listeners, which is in theoguide.net, ENTHEOGUIDE.net. If you go there, it has, among other things, the first couple of chapters of this book, which is How to Guide a Session Successfully and Safely. It has a lot of other things. I have nothing to do with this site, so I'm free to mention it. It's a wiki site, so people can add to it and have. And it's basically saying we'd like to have out there the best information we can, the safest information we can, and the most sacred information we can, so that people who want to better themselves have that opportunity. So it's also a way of protecting people who just need to know something, and who, I can't imagine who they would be, but there must be a few people who don't want to buy my book, but still are going to be interested in these substances. So when my publisher said to me, well, is this going to be a popular book for the general population? Assuming I was going to say yes, and I said, not in the slightest. I'm going for the tiny niche market of 23 million people. And they said, yeah, okay, we can live with that. So this is definitely not a book that says, oh, you don't know anything. This is a terrific book for you. This is a book that says, if you think you know something, you better read this book.
And it is chock full with the entire history of, I don't know about the entire history, but this is pretty much the most comprehensive guide put together yet of all the research into psychedelics, isn't it?
Well, this is the research most useful. When I got firstly into psychedelic research as a graduate student at Stanford, I wrote Sandoz Pharmaceuticals and said, hey, is there any other prior research? And they wrote back and they said, they didn't say hey, but whatever you'd say in Switzerland. They said, here's the first 1,000 studies.
Wow.
Now, this is the early 60s. This is before anything was available on the street. This is all hard science. It was, until it was banned, as having no medical use at all. That's what Schedule 1 means. It was the most researched psychiatric drug in the world.
Hmm.
So it's never made much sense.
Well, it sounds like somebody stepped in and made a decision about it on the government side, huh?
Well, the government had a problem, and I understand their problem, which is a bunch of young people were turning on, tuning in, and they were saying things like, I don't understand why we would go and kill people in Vietnam. We don't even know them. And there doesn't seem to be any economic interest. And also, the people who are going to kill them are me. And a lot of people, as you know, the war was enormously unpopular. I remember when Stanford shut itself, the students shut Stanford down to protest the war.
Mm-hmm.
And the government was realizing that the same people they thought who were against the war were also taking psychedelics. And the people taking psychedelics said, well, wait a moment, I don't quite understand the universities either, and I'm not too sure about the banks, and you just now have listed really large organizations that began to be frightened. And so somebody, and I have this imaginary moment in Washington where they're sitting around saying, all these kids are dropping whatever this substance is, and they go around talking about free love, and they're getting a lot of sex, and we're not. And they're seen to be really happy and living on very little money, which is a very bad kind of lifestyle.
They're not playing into the capitalist.
And someone said, well, we got to stop them. And everyone agreed they had to be stopped. And then someone said, well, how can we stop them? It's all underground and illegal. And someone said, well, we got to stop someone. And then someone in the back of the room said, how about all the science projects? We control those. We could stop something. And in my imaginary scenario, everyone says, yeah, we could stop something. And then they wrote a letter to 40 different projects across the country, ranging from ours, where we were doing psychotherapeutic research and turning on major scientists to their own inventions. And we had a lot of inventions come out of that project, things that were patented, things that were produced, things that were published. So we were doing really hard science. And on the other end, there was a guy somewhere, and I deliberately don't want to remember his name, who would give a drug to a mouse at a high dose, and then he would throw the mouse in water, and he would time how long the mouse could paddle. And it turned out he'd done that with many drugs over many years, and the government kept giving him money. So that was the range of projects, from really weird nuts projects to really nice people like us.
I was going to ask, too, you were with the West Coast Research Group in Menlo Park when you started. Were there other organizations or groups like that around the country at the same time?
There were very few. We were the International Foundation for Advanced Study, IFAS, and there was another group out of Harvard who were the International Federation, I think, for Internal Freedom, IF. Hmm. And they were a lot farther out than we were. And then on the West Coast, there was a kind of third group who were the unofficial researchers, which was Ken Kesey and the Band of Merry Pranksters, who were doing things that terrified all of us on West and East Coast, because we were a bunch of academics who were opening up, and they were a bunch of people who were way, way, way more open. But we were all experimenting. We were all clear. We didn't quite know what we were doing, but that this was incredibly important and valuable.
Jim Fadiman, our guest, he's going to be at Kepler's this Thursday night for his, is it your first book signing on this one?
This is actually the first book signing, and it's my local bookstore, and if you can't make it Thursday night, come to Kepler's for any reason, because they're one of the great cultural gifts that we happen to have here.
They sure are a local treasure, for sure.
Oh, and I want to just say one quick thing, which is to my listener in Brunswick, New Jersey, as well as to my listener somewhere off the African coast.
Yeah.
You're really more than welcome, and we're delighted you're here and delighted that you are on KZSU.
Thank you, Jim Fadiman. The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide is the book, Safe, Therapeutic, and Sacred Journeys. And we're going to come back right after a musical break and wind this thing up. This is some more Beatles for your listening pleasure on this Monday afternoon.
What would you think if I sang out of tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song, and I'll try not to sing out of key. Oh, I get by with a little help from my friend. I get high with a little help from my friend. Gonna try with a little help. Bye.
The Beatles, with a little help from my friends. All the songs picked today from James Fadiman, the author of the new book, The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide. And Jim, you got your PhD here at Stanford.
I did.
And you came here, well, you got a master's and a PhD here between 61 and 65. Came up from Southern, well, you came out from Harvard. And, no, I guess you'd been living in Paris.
Well, I finished Harvard, and my mentor was, as I said earlier in the show, Richard Alpert, now Ram Dass. And then I was writing a novel in Paris, as one, of course, should do at some point in one's life. And my draft board said, would you like to join us in Vietnam, or maybe you like to go to graduate school? And I thought, I was really not going to be a very good soldier, so I thought it was better to go to graduate school, and Stanford had accepted me. And we had a delicate relationship. I did a master's about psychedelics, and they were a little nervous, and it took me 2 years to get a committee for my PhD dissertation. Took me about 8 or 10 weeks to actually write it. And the very brave people who are on my committee, I hope that they feel okay about it.
And in thinking about that, you were probably the first one that ever did that, to get a dissertation on psychedelics.
Yeah, I did an experimental dissertation on what happens after you've had a major psychedelic experience in a good setting. What changes in your life? Not your belief system and not your attitudes, because that's kind of soft stuff, but really hard stuff like, do you watch television more? Do you eat more or less vegetables? Do you walk your dog more or less often? Do you quarrel more or less with your wife? So my dissertation, which is a chapter or two in the book, is all those kind of mundane things about how your life settles into a different rhythm when you've had an experience that lets you know you're more than you ever thought you were.
And as far as I know it, with these dissertations, it's usually it's supposed to be unique and different than anybody else did. But usually, there's some way that the committee can gauge it and go back and look at other information and compare it to it. Did they do it right? Is it official? But when you do a dissertation that early on psychedelics, which nobody else had done, what they must have been nervous because they had nothing to gauge it on. They didn't know anything about it, did they?
Well, one of my committee members, actually, Professor Willis Harmon, by that time knew a huge amount because he and I had worked together for 4 years by that time. But I said it as, let's look at how you evaluate psychotherapy, which after all has a beginning and an end, and after it's over, you should be able to measure something. And then I said, well, here's psychedelic psychotherapy, and it has a really easy beginning and end because it takes place over one day. But we can then ask the same questions we would of anything else, which is, how was it afterwards for you? Same question could be asked of, you know, I have a Stanford BA. I spent 4 years here. What's different about me that we could say Stanford had something to do with? And so it's a very reasonable question. And I found when I went to the psychotherapy literature, assuming there'd be a massive amount, there was almost nothing on what happens to normal life after psychotherapy. And so I was in new territory, but I cast it as this is just part of one normal questions one should ask about any therapy. And my committee was very supportive. And so the dissertation is as dull as I could possibly make it on a very exciting subject.
James Fadiman. Now, Jim, how did this change or alter or enhance your relationship with, on your personal level, with your family? And the wife and kids didn't come along till a little later, right?
Right.
But how did it change your, how did you feel that studying psychedelics and taking them changed you?
Well, it's a huge question, since I've spent the rest of my life working out what I really experienced on those early psychedelic experiences. And what I experienced was that the Jim Fadiman, for all his positives and negatives, is a subset of who I really am. And that I am larger than my personality. And there's every religious tradition talks about it. And one learns, say, in Christianity, to say one is not of the world, but one is in the world. And that means that there's a larger framework than my life and than my personality. And so since that time, I've felt much more comfortable being Jim Fadiman and trying to improve on that part of the system. But it's also, people say, well, I am just who I am, and that's all I am. I say to them, that's like saying you're your shirt. You know, it covers you, it completes you, it's all around you, but hey, it's not you. There's more to you than your external appearance, and there's more to you than your personality. Out of that, I helped develop a field of psychology, which we call transpersonal, or beyond the personality. We have a graduate school. We've been in business 35 years. There's 18 countries in Europe that have transpersonal organizations, and so on and so on. So it's been the defining focus of my life, which is how can I understand at the level of Jim Fadiman the more that I am. And so when I was a graduate student, I was being a graduate student by day, and in the evening I was reading whatever I could to try and understand more, which meant I was reading the I Ching from the Chinese tradition, I was reading things in Tibetan Buddhism, I was reading in Hinduism, I was reading in mystical Christianity, and all those people seemed to be talking more about what I'd experienced than what I was hearing in my daytime world in psychology at Stanford. So I was basically getting world psychology or universal psychology or eternal psychology, and that's where I'm still working. I did a novel about young people in the hate called The Other Side of Hate, and they are taking a lot of psychedelics, obviously. And in that, the whole reason I wrote the book is there's a perfect model of an ideally run psychedelic session in that book. And, you know, many years later now, I'm doing it again, only more formally in this book. So I'm pretty stuck on the notion that if it's worth doing, it's worth doing well. And if it may be the most important thing in your life, it's really worth doing well. So that's probably been from my research in the 60s until right now.
James Fadiman helped found the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology. That's what you were just talking about. You're right. still teaching there now. And that's located here on the peninsula?
That is located in the midst of an industrial part of Palo Alto.
Okay.
Where we have a lovely building, which after the dot-com revolution blew up, everybody was very, very glad that we were there to rent at a very low rate from them. We have a beautiful small campus. And we also have students from around the world. We have some global programs, and we have a bunch of master's programs and PhD programs. And it's what I looked at. We probably have a considerably larger psychology clientele, so to speak, than Stanford. Stanford has many more faculty because it's much more of a research institution. But we are a major source of clinical psychologists for the San Francisco Bay Area.
Hmm. The Institute of Transpersonal Psychology. Also the author of 14 books?
Something like that.
Well, your wife said it was. And got to throw a shout out to Dorothy Fadiman, a guest of this show many times, and we all love her, and she's been your wife for how many years now?
It's been well over 40.
And both you two experienced psychedelic drugs and talk highly about how it enhanced your life experience.
Well, we're aware, like many people of our generation, that we had this opportunity that we didn't know anything about. We truly were naive and brought up in our little, you know, parochial cultures. And we found a communality in that we were part of a universal. It's in a sense the way ecology says very realistically, everything's connected to everything else, which if you stop for a moment is the only obvious thing in the universe. And what you find out when you let go of your limits, of your personal limits, that if you're with someone else who shares that, who understands that, who groks that, that you are way ahead of the game in terms of relationships. So that when the Jim Fadiman and Dorothy Fadiman personalities don't work very well, we can step back and say, that's just their personalities. They'll get over it. The affection and caring they have for each other comes from a different part of their core.
Which has probably kept you guys together all these years, right?
Oh, yeah. We're just thrilled to be with each other, and we still delight in each other, and we still are aware that we are changing, and that the people we were many years ago, they were okay for then, but we think if we kind of believe we're like trees, which is if you're not growing, you got to look at that.
Yeah, if you're not growing, you're dying, right?
Well, that's the I didn't want to push that side of it.
James Fadiman, this has been a wonderful hour, and your book is amazing. It is a psychedelic explorer's guide. It's chock full of great information from a lot of different folks, too. A lot of your colleagues, you put together probably the most comprehensive study of psychedelics ever put in a book, I think.
So far, you're right, and I'm hoping to be superseded soon.
People can get a hold of you by going on your website, jamesfadiman.com, F-A-D-I-M-A-N.com, and I'm sure you'll be having more book events coming up soon if they miss the Kepler's one, huh?
Yeah, I will be having one September 30th at the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology. Oh. That'll be a kind of honor the faculty book event. And I will be probably doing something in San Francisco, hopefully at City Lights. That's not scheduled. And at East West in Mountain View, that's where we're looking. But those are not confirmed, so don't push on those stores at all.
But they'll show up on your website probably, yeah. Too, huh?
Schedule, et cetera.
Jim, thank you very much for your time.
It was a genuine pleasure to be here, and I'm thrilled to finally get onto your show.
Thank you. And say hi to your wife for us. And we're going to go out with Janis Joplin, Down on Me.